Right then, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to Postcolonial Kenya, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, A Grain of Wheat. That's the title of lecture this week. My name is Vedita and I'm a PhD student, first year, working with Pablo Mukherjee, if you want to know. And yeah, I'm just going to be lecturing for this one. Right then. Novelist, essayist, theorist, literary critic, playwright, journalist, editor, academic, and social activist. These are the very many facets of the versatile writer in discussion today. And indeed, one couldn't have chosen a more appropriate voice to speak for or on behalf of postcolonial Kenya. May I start by drawing your attention to the title of this lecture? Not chosen by me, I hasten to add, but very aptly chosen all the same. Thank you. The first reference in this title is to a whole country, Kenya, at one specific point in time, that is after the period of colonization, hence post-colonial. The second, to one particular man working in or on Kenya. And the third reference is to one particular novel from the inexhaustible list of publication that this one man has churned out in his life. These are three very different spheres, I'm sure you will all agree. But what is it about this one book that makes it the chosen representative of not only its creator, but is also deemed to encompass the whole story of postcolonial Kenya itself, if not of other postcolonial countries as well? We'll start by talking about the middle sphere, the man himself. Given how prolific our writer is, a one-hour lecture is obviously never enough to talk about him, but I'm going to try my best to give you an overview of the running thread in his works, which is inextricably bound with his political and social beliefs, and which I hope to show in the end, is epitomized to a large extent in this one novel in question. Ngugi wa Thiong'o is still alive. I think that's the first thing you need to know about him, because he's probably the only one you will study in this literature of the modern world period who didn't die before we were all born. He's very much active still. His last book, entitled Something Torn and New, The African Renaissance, was published last year. And in fact, actually, if we had had this lecture 2 weeks ago, I would probably have told you that he would be in London on the 7th of March speaking about his forthcoming book entitled Dreams in a Time of War, A Childhood Memoir, which is due to release later this month. But anyway, tough luck. Ngugi wa Thiong'o is currently a Distinguished Professor of English and Comparative Literature at the University of California in Irvine. He was born in Kenya in 1938, and of the exact date and month, he's himself not sure. He was born into a large peasant family of the Kikuyu tribe. I'll just write Kikuyu here. Kikuyu, also written Gikuyu. That's a squiggle here. It's the name of the tribe as well as of the language spoken by this tribe. His mother underwent a lot of hardship to have him educated, but she was very determined, and so he succeeded in completing his primary education in Kamanjura, in Mangu, and in Kinyogiri primary schools, after which he went to Alliance High School in Kenya, Makerere University College, which was then a campus of London University in Kampala, which is in Uganda. After that, he came to the University of Leeds, which is obviously in Britain. He is the recipient of no less than 7 doctorates, honorary doctorates, namely a D.Litt from Albright, a PhD from Roskilde, a D.Litt from Leeds, a D.Litt and PhD from Walter Sisulu University, a PhD from Cal State, a D.Litt from Dillard, and a D.Litt from Auckland Universities. Wow, right? He's also honorary member of the American Academy of Letters. Ngugi started writing as a second-year undergraduate. You guys have a year. While he was a student at Makerere University. His advent onto the East African literary scene was marked by the play The Black Hermit, which was first performed in Uganda in 1962 as part of the celebration of Uganda's independence. Along with several short stories and one-act plays, he also wrote a regular column entitled As I See It for the local newspaper, Sunday Nation, and wrote two novels, all of this whilst he was at university. The first of these novels, entitled Weep Not, Child, was published to critical acclaim in 1964, followed by the second novel, which was called The River Between, in 1965. A Grain of Wheat came out in 1967, and in a lot of ways, this novel came to define the literary identity of Googie in a way that his previous writings had not quite finalized, both in terms of the structure of his writing and its shaping ideology. The influence of Frantz Fanon, who would guide his writing thereafter, becomes palpable in this novel, for instance. Frantz Fanon, I'm sure you wouldn't have come across him at this stage, but Frantz Fanon is an author from Martinique, and he's one of the most influential figures in the field of post-colonial studies. His books, such as Les Damnés de la Terre, which is translated in English as The Wretched of the Earth, and Peau Noire, Masque Blanc, which is Black Skin, White Masks, have inspired several critics working on decolonization and anti-colonial liberation movements around the world. But I'll say more about Fanon and his influence later. In 1967, which is the year in which Grain of Wheat came out, Googie also became lecturer of English literature at the University of Nairobi. He taught there until 1977, while in between also serving as fellow in creative writing at Makerere and as visiting associate professor of English and African Studies at Northwestern University. The year 1977 was hugely significant for Googie's life and career. His first novel in 10 years, entitled Petals of Blood, was published in July of that year. The novel painted a harsh and inspiring picture of life in newly independent Kenya. It was received with emphatic acclaim, critical acclaim, in Kenya and abroad. The same year, Googie's controversial play Gahika Ndinda, which is translated in English as I Will Marry When I Want, co-written with Googie Wamiri, no relation as far as I know. This play was performed at Kamiritu Education and Cultural Center in Limuru, in an open-air theater with actors who were workers and peasants from the village. At the end of this very year, so on the 31st of December 1977, Googie was imprisoned under the Public Security Act for a year, without trial, for his involvement in the performance of this play. The play, along with his novel Petals of Blood, with its keen sense of contemporary political events, had struck the wrong chord with the ruling government. Jomo Kenyatta, the first president of independent Kenya, was in his last year of rule, and his vice president, Daniel Toroitik Arap Moi, had already started exerting more influence at that point. Both of the works mentioned above focused on exploit and corruption in present-day Kenya. Petals of Blood was the story of an investigation of murder of three representatives of the new society who profited from the new order prevailing after independence. And I Will Marry When I Want highlighted the oppression and lack of security which the impoverished rural inhabitants of Kenya still suffered from after independence. It is in prison that Googie made the decision to abandon English as his primary language of creative writing and committed himself to writing in Kikuyu, his mother tongue, instead. He wrote on toilet paper the novel entitled Kaitani Muturabaini in 1981, which later got translated into English as Devil on the Cross. As news of Googie's imprisonment spread, Amnesty International got involved and the organization declared him prisoner of conscience. The international campaign that followed this secured his release a year later, that is in December 1978. However, Arap Moi, who had succeeded Kenyatta as the president of Kenya by the time of Googie's release, barred Googie from jobs at colleges and universities in the country. I should actually, at this point, say something about the governance of Moi. Initially, Moi worked in alliance with Kenyatta's ideas, but he was a staunch anti-communist from the very onset, which did not go down well with Gugi, given how influenced Gugi was by Fanon and his adaptation of Marxism in the African context. Academics and intellectuals at large in Kenya were against Moi because of the way Moi gradually dismissed political opponents, including Kenyatta's men, whom he eventually termed as traitors. He changed the constitution to establish a de jure, single party state, and he banned the study of Marxism in Kenyan universities. In short, he had all the characteristics of a despot worth his salt. Despite the threat, Gugi, however, still continued writing articles, plays, and stories which addressed and censored the Moi dictatorship, and so he became an obvious victim. While Gugi was in Britain for the launch and promotion of Devil on the Cross, he learned about the plot of Moi's regime to eliminate him on his return. This forced him into self-exile, first in Britain and then into the US. And during this time, the Moi dictatorship still hounded him and tried to get him expelled first from London and then from the other countries he visited. In fact, I think in 86, he sent an assassination squad in Harare, where Gugi was attending a conference. And I mean, that squad was eventually thwarted, but fact remains that he did try to get him killed as well. Gugi's next Kikuyu novel, entitled Matigari, was published in 1986. And thinking that the novel's main character was a real living person, Moi issued a warrant for his arrest. But on learning that the character was fictional, he had the novel banned instead. Undercover police went to all the bookshops in the country and the publisher's warehouse and took the novel away. So between 86 and 96, Matigari could not be sold in Kenyan bookshops. In exile, Gugi worked with a London-based committee for the release of political prisoners in Kenya. This committee championed the cause of democratic and human rights in Kenya. And in between, Gugi was also a visiting professor at Bayreuth University and writing residence for the borough of Islington in London. He even went back to studies to read film at Dramatiska Institute, which is in Stockholm, Sweden, obviously. In 1989 and up to 1992, Gugi was visiting professor of English and comparative literature at Yale. He then became professor of comparative literature and performance studies at New York University. And from there, he moved to his present position at the University of California in Irvine. He remained in exile for the duration of the Moi dictatorship. When him and his wife, Jiri, returned to Kenya in 2004, after 22 years in exile, they were attacked by hired gunmen and narrowly escaped with their lives. His wife was raped, he was beaten, he had his face burnt with cigarette stubs. It was actually horrible. You will probably find all of this on his website homepage, which I've given on the handout. So if you're interested, you can read about this later. Anyway, so much about the man himself, and now about the context from which he emerges. May I, ladies and gentlemen, draw your attention to the first quote on your handout, please? I'll just read it out. Over the years, I have come to realize more and more that work, any work, even literary creative work, is not the result of an individual genius, but the result of a collective effort. There are so many inputs in the actual formation of an image, an idea, a line of argument, and even sometimes the formal arrangement. The very words we use are a product of a collective history. This quote is taken from his book called Decolonizing the Mind, which I strongly recommend if you really want to pursue postcolonial studies later. But, I mean, my point here is that it is very important for us to realize that his belief in this claim informs and pervades all of Gugi's writing. The works of this man is inextricably linked to the context from which he emerges. Gugi is very much an activist who uses the medium of writing to awaken his readers to a reality which they may otherwise be indifferent to, which is not to say that his tales are didactic or moral or whatever. But for instance, the reason why Moi arrested Gugi is because Gugi does not just write for the sake of writing. He writes for the sake of raising awareness and for the sake of exposing reality, as people may not be aware of it. In this, his writing takes a deliberate break from the dictum of early European modernists, for instance, who abided by the belief in art for art's sake. Other African writers such as Léopold Senghor and Chinua Achebe had criticized this aphorism as being restricted to a Eurocentric view on art and creation. And Senghor had even gone as far as to say that, and I quote here, in black African aesthetics, art is functional, and in black Africa, art for art's sake does not exist. Gugi too shows his break from this European tradition by fighting to forge parameters against which to judge African literature in its own right, not in relation to Europe or any other literature. He abhors the linguistic demarcation of African countries in terms of English speaking, French speaking, or Portuguese speaking, and fought against such denominations which would place Africa in purview of Europe. In the 70s, Gugi ditched the name James, a very good name to my belief. Please don't, I think it's an excellent name, but Gugi didn't like the name James because James was a Christian name. And for Gugi, Christianity was linked, and this name was linked to the religion and language of his colonial master. Gugi was baptized in childhood, but he did not see himself as a man of the church. As he would put it later in his essay, Culture, Church, Culture, and Politics, you can read that later if you like. Christianity, which was brought into Africa by European missionaries during the time of the colonial conquest, was for Gugi imperialism's unquestioned religious ally. For Christianity was part and parcel of Europe's cultural imperialism for Gugi. And the adoption of Christianity inevitably led to the rejection of the formerly valued African culture. This was basically equated by Gugi as an effacement of one's self for the sake of mimicking the norms and ways of one's oppressor. In his book entitled Homecoming, Gugi explains this attitude by saying that Christianity meant rejection of values and rituals that held us together. It meant adopting what, in effect, was a debased European middle-class mode of living and behavior. The European missionary had attacked the primitive rites of our people, had condemned our beautiful African dances, the images of our gods recoiling from their suggestion of satanic sensuality. This is a quote, and this is the end of the quote. So the adoption of the more traditional name is a Kikuyu name, so the name Wasyongo, which incidentally is also Gugi's father's name, was therefore Gugi's rejection of not only the discourse, but also the set of values and culture of the colonizer. Later, he would indeed take this rejection further by ceasing to write in English entirely. Gugi's decision to stop writing in English was very likely prompted by his reading of Fanon's Black Skin, White Masks. Because in Black Skin, White Masks, Fanon puts forth the claim that, and I think this is again on your handout, I'll just read it out. To speak means above all to assume a culture, to support the weight of a civilization. Every colonized people, in other words, every people in whose soul an inferiority complex has been created by the death and burial of its local cultural originality, finds itself face to face with the language of the civilizing nation, that is, with the culture of the mother country. To speak a language is to take on a world, a culture. End of quote. In the light of this claim, writing in English would have implied participation in the cultural genocide of the Africans, which would have gone against the grain of Gugi's ideals, and he therefore gave up English entirely. But even in his earlier and then later English writings, Gugi imports many words from Kikuyu, Swahili, and other African languages without glossing them. In a grain of wheat, for instance, which obviously is written in English, Gugi includes words like shamba, djembe, panga, gakaru, and bangi, which are not part of our usual repertoire of vocabulary, but which never get explained in the text. We are left to guess from the context what, for instance, words like even uhuru or gikoi might mean. I think that, well, it's my argument, that this seemingly insignificant oversight is most likely not an oversight. Because by importing these foreign words in his English writing, Googie molds the language in such a way as to make the ex-colonial master, whose vestige English is, obviously, uneasy about reading things that become unfamiliar to him in his own language. As put by critic Anya Lumba, challenging and overhauling the Eurocentric notion of language was an essential part of decolonization, and that is precisely what Googie does by defamiliarizing the English language for the non-African English readers. During his tenure at Nairobi University, Googie was at the center of politics of English departments in Africa. He championed the change of name of the department from English to simply literature, so as to reflect world literature with African and third world literatures at the center. He, along with Tabalo Leong and Awar Anyumba, authored the polemical declaration, which they entitled On the Abolition of the English Department, which set off the motion, which set off a continental and global debate. And they also evoked practices that would later become the heart of post-colonial theories. I think it's on the second quote on your handout, which is taken from Homecoming. Googie expands on this. It's quite a long quote, but I think it's worth reading it out, so I'll just read it all. So Googie says, "We have been trying all along to place values where they belong. We have argued the case for the abolition of the present Department of English in the college and the establishment of the Department of African Literature and Languages. This is not a change of names only. We want to establish the centrality of Africa in the department. This is justifiable on various grounds, the most important one being that education is a means of knowledge about ourselves. The dominant object in the perspective is African literature, the major branch of African culture. Its roots go back to past African literature, European literature, and Asian literature. These can only be studied meaningfully in a department of African literature and languages in an African university." Just before I go on, I want to clear something. You will no doubt notice the repeated concepts with centrality. Googie uses it several times to show how Africa is made to be peripheral in relation to Europe, which Europe is then projected as the center. This is the prejudice he argues against in his novel entitled, well, not novel, it's a book, it's not a novel at all, Moving the Center. Because colonial masters had always anticipated their own centrality in the universe, as the body wielding cultural, political, and economic power. So in Moving the Center, Googie argues that in order to correct the imbalances of the last centuries of colonial domination and for freedom in all its senses, the need is to move the center from its assumed location in the West to a multiplicity of spheres in all the cultures of the world. So the importance of the center, just to show, is recurrent in a lot of African writing. I think in a different way, Ashibe also evokes this notion of the center in the epigram. I don't know if anyone would have heard of, would have read Things Fall Apart. In the epigram to Things Fall Apart, there's this quote from a poem by Yeats in which the verses which he quotes are, "Things fall apart, the center doesn't hold, and mere anarchy is loosened upon the world," which is a quote from Yeats' poem called The Second Coming. Here, obviously, center in Yeats' poem, sorry, in Achebe's use of Yeats' poem, the center is the reference to the African culture, which Christianity displaces. But I just want to say that this obsession with center is really quite recurrent in African writing. But anyway, coming back to my previous point, the colonial ideology, which really prizes the centrality of Imperial England, gets censored within a grain of wheat through characters such as D.O. Thompson. Thompson is a diehard upholder of values of imperialism, which makes him look upon imperial conquest as a benevolent and selfless task for the betterment of an ignorant and primitive people. At one point, he even refers to the Negro, a quote, not my word, as a child in need of rescue through authority and command. He has all the characteristics of the arch-imperialist. If I can urge you to stretch your memory back to the lecture of last week, I know you did Conrad's Hearts of Darkness, you will remember that, you will probably realize that Thompson and Mr. Coates from Heart of Darkness have a lot of similarities. Just as an aside here, I should point out that Googie was rather fond of the works of Joseph Conrad, actually. He knew, so he was acquainted with Conrad. For he chose to study Conrad whilst at university and Macquarie, and saw in Conrad an affinity of sensibility in his treatment of the African subject. If you want to pursue this further, I would urge you to read the article by Nazareth, which I've included in this handout and in the bibliography, but that's obviously for later. Anyway, coming back to our two imperialists in the African jungle, there are a lot of similarities. Can anyone think of any immediate similarities? There are really quite a lot. Anything that jumps to your mind? I'm assuming you've read both, hopefully. No? None? Okay, never mind. Well, Coates authors a pamphlet regarding the civilization of the natives. Thompson works on a book called Prospero in Africa. Coates sees his mission as philanthropic, so does Thompson. Coates does not shy away from violence and coercion to get the job at hand done, nor does Thompson. Even Coates' memorable line, exterminate all the brutes, which Norbert pointed out last week, he argued last week that this line, exterminate all the brutes, lies at the very heart of the imperializing mission, finds an echo in Thompson's, can anyone think of the quote I'm going to say here? Thompson says something which is very similar. Well done, thank you. So eliminate the vermin, which in this book is on page 130. On the fourth quote on your handout, we find Thompson ruminating on what got him interested in the British Empire and its tasks. Can you just read the, well, all, can we all just read the quote on the fourth handout, which is, it was in Oxford, whilst reading history, that he found himself interested in the development of the British Empire. At first, this was a historian's interest, without personal involvement. But drifting into the poems of Rudyard Kipling, he experienced a swift flicker, a flame awakened. He saw himself as a man with destiny, a man poised for great things in the future. My heart was filled with joy, he wrote later. In a flash, I was convinced that the growth of the British Empire was the development of a great moral idea. The reference to Kipling here is really quite interesting, for Kipling himself was a staunch imperialist who believed in the white man's burden, in the sense of the duty that the white man has been entrusted with vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And I need a volunteer here. I'm a bit tired. So can someone read the very long poem which I've reproduced on the handout? If no one volunteers, I'll actually make everyone read it. So please find a volunteer. No? Okay, we'll do something. I'll say the first line. Can you say the second line then? And then third line and the fourth line. Yeah? Okay? Take up the white man's burden.
Thank you.
you. A little round of applause for you. Well done. Come on, clap yourself. No, okay. Nobody feels like clapping, never mind. Anyway, whether the values are flaunted here, I'm sure you would, you know, you actually read about, well, spoke out the values, so I'm sure you know what I mean when I say the values flaunted here were truly the founding pillars of empire, or whether these were merely the pretty picture painted over to camouflage empire more mercantile interest is another question. But Thompson's conviction in the moral imperative of empire and of its indispensability to lesser civilizations is unmoved. Even as empire comes to an end, and Marjorie makes this very caustic analogy of the way she sees it has turned out, which is the third quote on your handout, when she says, instead she had felt the shame of a child who sees a grown-up suddenly caught in the act of chasing a butterfly over fields and roads. So even as Marjorie makes this remark, Thompson still asserts, we are not yet beaten. Africa cannot do without Europe. However, though Thompson's colonial spirit remains unbeaten, there is no denying that the point at which Googie penned these works was the high noon of colonial struggle. In an interview with Jeff Koinange on Capital Talk Bench last year, an interview which you can actually watch on YouTube if you just type in Googie Capital Talk Bench, I'm sure it comes up. So in this interview, Googie admits that his writing fed off the global energy, and energy is really a word he emphasizes again and again, the energy of anti-colonial struggle, which had been rife since a few decades already preceding his advent onto the literary scene. He mentions what had happened in Ghana, in the Caribbean, in China, and even in India. India's colonial struggle actually gets referred to over and over again in the novel. And Kihika, for instance, is shown to be a great admirer of Mahatma Gandhi. I quote from one of the speeches assigned to Kihika on page 86. It's a quote, so. It's a question of unity, Kihika says. The example of India is there before our noses. The British were there for hundreds and hundreds of years. They ate India's wealth, they drank India's blood. They never listened to the political talk of a few men. What happened? There came this one man, Gandhi. Mark you, Gandhi knows his white men well. He goes round and round and organizes the Indian masses into a weapon stronger than the bomb. They say with one voice, we won't back our freedom, and so on and so forth. You can read this. It's on page 86 here later. I mentioned at the beginning that Googie prides himself seeing how his writing is shaped by a collective history. Googie's collective history is here shown to encompass not only that of Kenya in Africa, but the rest of the three quarters of the world affected at one point in one way or another by colonization, not just European colonization, by colonization. So I mentioned that a grain of wheat can be viewed not only as representing Googie and Kenya, but can also be seen as speaking for the post-colonial world in the way that formerly colonized countries were collectively participating in moving the focus away from Europe to other parts of the world. The center, as he would put it in Moving the Center, was being displaced and fragmented. I would like to suggest that a grain of wheat, through its structure, enacts this displacement of the center. Though there is a third-person narrator who holds the story together and often hints at his foresight of events and displays clear political awareness of Kenya's colonial history, the narrative often shifts to individual characters who, in the words of Abdul Razak Gurnah, who writes the introduction to this, so these characters tell their stories in confessional encounters and in interior monologues, stories which intersect and challenge each other, and which, in formal sense, are inaccessible to the narrator. In this way, the narrative frequently slips in and out of present time, and between narrative voices, creating some instability about what is known and what it means to know. My argument is that these multiple centers of selves, as it were, displace the hegemony or autonomy of any single character by giving different entry routes into the story. This is very much in keeping with Googie's fight to abolish any one particular point of view, whether this be the Eurocentric view or the view of the freedom-seeking Mau Mau, or of those who, despite being native, reject the view held by the majority of their community, or even those of the more idle onlookers who, almost against their will, get implicated in this story. So there may be no moral base to Thompson's position, but the latter is still given the space in which to express himself in the novel. Kihika may be the martyred hero of Thabai, but we also hear Mugo's perspective on how Kihika disrupted the pattern of his own existence. Karanja may be the deserter of the African cause, but we witness his dilemma at the imminent departure of the white man too. So that's one aspect of the structure. And the other interesting aspect of the novel structure is the way in which it showcases the way Kenya moved towards its Uhuru and how things changed for the Kenyans in the process. Through the narrative montage, we learn of the origin of the struggle for independence in Kenya and of the way it is eventually gained. A lot of historical and political ground gets covered. Googie takes us back and forth to juxtapose the state of affairs in Kenya during the emergency, when the rebellion of the Mau Mau was at their peak, to the few days preceding Uhuru. Uhuru is independence. Just by the way here, anyone knows when Kenya's Uhuru was? Any idea of the date? It's mentioned. No? Okay. It's on the 12th of December, 1963. But along with showcasing the heroic struggle, Googie also shows us the despair and disillusionment that accompany such struggles. In the words of critic Killam, I quote, "We see people placed in a context where a leader emerges who articulates the plight of the generality of people, explain the reasons why the circumstances obtain, and then prompt a people to action. Following the action, where certain gains are made, there is an equal amount of disillusion and despair. The novel does not come to a satisfactory ending, insofar as the ideals which are sought are achieved. There are no easy solutions to the problems. They remain." The last sentence ascribed to Wambui in the penultimate chapter, when she's looking around the hut, and that sentence is, "How can dirt so quickly collect in a clean hut?" But she did not rise to do anything. This is on page 239, I think. Yes? This quote, I think, is an apt reflection of the state of affairs, even after Uhuru has been won. We must keep in mind, actually, that Googie is writing this novel in 1967, which is 4 years already since Uhuru was achieved. And in those 4 years, Googie already had to face the disenchantment that followed Kenya's freedom. His cynical, unresolved ending, with things still hanging in the air, therefore precedes his works such as Petals of Blood and I Will Marry When I Want, in which the dissatisfaction with the state of affairs after Uhuru is not at all masked. How long do we have? Okay. So my last point, which, to be honest, probably should have been my first point, is on the title of the novel. Any idea where the title is derived from? No? Okay, well, it's from John's Gospel, Bible. Biblical reference. John's Gospel, chapter 12, verses 24 to 25, yes. And I'll just quote those verses here. "Most solemnly, I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it is and will only be a grain of wheat. But if it dies, it will bear much fruit. He who loves his life shall lose it, but he who hates his life in this world shall keep it forever and ever." End of quote. This idea of self-sacrifice and new birth, which is evoked in this quote, and which most often gets associated to Kihika, can actually be related to more than one character within the novel. Kihika is obviously ostensibly the more religious of the characters. But, for example, all his biblical quotations, which he underlines in his Bible, Sorry, that was blasphemy, I'm sure. So all the quotes which he underlines in the Bible evoke this need of self-sacrifice and attest to legitimize and support his involvement with the Mau Mau. For instance, at one point he quotes from, not he quotes, but he refers to Christianity and the Bible and says to Karanja that, yes, Jesus had failed because his death did not change anything. It did not make his people find a center in the cross. Note the significance of the word center here. All oppressed people have a cross to bear. The Jews refused to carry it and were scattered like dust all over the earth. Had Christ's death a meaning for the children of Israel? In Kenya, we want a death that will change things. That is to say, we want a true sacrifice. But first, we have to be ready to carry the cross. I die for you, you die for me. We become a sacrifice for one another. So Kihika is, as I say, this ostensibly, you know, very religious. He evokes the Bible, but he evokes it because he really believes in this whole notion of self-sacrifice, which he tries to show comes up in the Bible again and again. But other than Kihika, there are other characters in this novel who die in a more metaphoric sense so that others may live. Mugo, for instance, carries the burden of his sin throughout the novel. We see him paining under the weight of this burden several times. And at the end, he, who had been afraid of death, sacrifices himself by owing up to his involvement in Kihika's death so that the sins of others may be absolved. In doing so, not only does he clear Karanja of the charge that would otherwise have claimed his life, but he also gives new life to Mumbi and Gikonyo. But rather than purging, his sacrifice seems to only make characters like Gikonyo and Karanja come face to face with their own devils. So, I mean, this is something gone wrong with the self-sacrifice. When he hears of how Mugo had owned up to his crime, Gikonyo, lying in hospital, realizes his own cowardice and says, "Remember that few people in that meeting are fit to lift a stone against that man. Not unless we, too, in our turn, open our hearts, naked for the world to look at." Karanja, saved from death due to Mugo's sacrifice, says to himself, "Now that power has gone, and Mumbi has finally rejected him, for what then had Mugo saved Karanja? Life was empty, like the dark and the mist that enclosed the earth." So whether Mugo's sacrifice will be worthwhile is not certain. What with the last scene in which Mumbi walks away from the repentant Gikonyo with determined steps. There is a general sense of anticlimax, actually, which one would not have expected from a people newly freed from the bond of colonization at the end of the novel. The Uhuru Day does not bring about the much-awaited jubilation and sense of exaltment. He who everyone had viewed as a hero, Mugo, is found to be imperfect. People such as the MP, remember him at the beginning, Gikonyo going to see him? So this MP who steals the land of Mr. Burton from Gikonyo, they are the people who are taking over the running of Kenya. General R's comments in one of the last chapters throws a very ominous light on the implication of this new grain which has been sown and is expected to bear fruit. And this is the quote which I will actually end with. So this is my last word. So the quote is, General R says, "You ask why we fought, why we lived in the forest with wild beasts. You ask why we killed and spilled blood. The white man went in cars. He lived in a big house. His children went to school. But who tilled the soil on which he grew coffee, tea, pyrethrum, and sisal? Who dug the roads and paid the taxes? The white man lived on our land. He ate what we grew and cooked, and even the crumbs from the table he threw to his dogs. That is why we went into the forest." Mau Mau, for instance, by the way. "He who was not on our side was against us. That is why we killed our black brothers. Because in sight, they were white men. And I know even now that this war is not ended. We get Uhuru today. Tomorrow we shall ask, where is the land? Where is the food? for other schools. Let, therefore, these things be done now, for we do not want another war. No more blood in these, in our hands. Thank you.